welcome to Brought to the Table, a podcast by friends for friends. Today we have Diana Schulberg, Ian Walker, myself, Carter Van Hus. Normally we would have Caitlin Phillips, but she's out today for personal reasons, and Scott Pruitt. This show, we pair off into two groups of two, and normally one freeloader, and we bring topics to the table that we find interesting or relevant or fun. Today, the groups are myself and Diana. We'll be talking about Overwatch, and Scott and Ian, who will be talking about robotic prosthetics. And to pick who goes first, I'm going to actually request Ian and Diana to go head-to-head in a Jeopardy-style a trivia competition of my own design. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. Now
I can do it. I'm really good at these things.
It is Shrek themed.
Are you doubting my Shrek knowledge?
Okay. All right. So Scott, you want it?
I'm in.
Okay. Scott v. Diana.
All right.
So Lord Farquaad, whose voice actor I don't actually know who it was, originally was cast as somebody else as well. Somebody from the Harry Potter series. What actor from the Harry Potter series was originally cast as Lord Farquaad?
I could tell you the animator he was based on, but I can't tell you. That's cool.
Interesting.
Just think about it. Like, literally anyone can answer this.
I'm going to go with the person who plays Snape.
You're right, dude. That's it. Alan Rickman. Wait, really? Alan Rickman was originally slated to play Lord Farquaad.
What?
So we are going to go with Scott and Ian first, which is great because I wanted to go second. Anyways, so yeah, Scott and Ian, what have you brought to the table for us?
All right, so today we're bringing robotic prosthesis, which is a topic that apparently Ian and I have in common, and it's more like I like robots. So let's go with some background first. Like, prosthetics have been around for a long time, obviously, as like wars and stuff are kind of the wars, armies are primary customers or primary causes, but the research into like more advanced and more functional prosthetics really took off in like the 20th century, mostly because of the world wars and government funded research. So wherever there's money, there will be, you know, new products or new solutions to problems. And we start to see what most people I think would refer to as robotic prosthetics in the like second half or the later part of the 20th century. We start to see like microcontroller-based prosthetic knees in the 90s. So let's talk about some of the kind of, I'd say, less advanced types of robotic prostheses. The kind of earliest kind of non just like static or, non-static prostheses are...
Kind of like the non-passive ones?
Yeah, non-passive. That's the word I was looking for. So we have these things called myoelectric prosthesis, which are controlled with existing muscle signals. So they interface with your body in a way that is already there, but they're externally powered. So like you have to have a battery or they have to be plugged in some way, and you have to recharge them or keep them plugged in at all times. But they get signals via sensors that they can like place somewhere on your body, and it sends it to like a microcontroller that's in there that has, you know, some actuator that can actually do the motion that a normal limb or a normal body part would do. This is in contrast with like other functional prosthetics that are body powered, which take explicit movement from other parts. Like you can control something with your shoulder or other parts of your body. And contrasting with passive, it actually moves. Although passive things can be useful in other situations, like if you have a hook or a like specially designed prosthetic. As far as design of like more modern prosthetics, especially robotic ones, they're pretty amazing engineering feats. They're designed just like pretty much anything these days with CAD or computer assisted design. So you basically have somebody in software able to spec out down to the micro detail exactly what it's going to look like. And they use CAM or computer aided manufacturing, which is basically either 3D printing or having a robot controlled by software that's going to cut metal or cut other parts. And assemble it like very, very precisely. And they also have, you know, not necessarily typical, but they have very interesting engineering challenges that you might see in other areas, but maybe not this intersection of them. You have things like battery life, which is kind of common across multiple small devices that are engineering challenges, but also weight, because if the prosthetic is, you know, significantly heavier, it's a much bigger burden on the person who has to use it. So they use advanced manufacturing, materials like carbon fiber and stuff. And you also have like a very, very high bar for comfort and usability, and that like ideally your ideal bar is it's as usable as like something that has literally been a part of somebody for most of their life or almost all of their life. And so you have to kind of overcome that hurdle to get it to the ideal scenario.
Yeah, which I think like a lot of that is really interesting with the engineering challenges that they face. Like, there's not a lot of times that you really think about battery life if it's not something like a phone or a laptop or something like that. Most of the time, if it's battery life, you just recharge it easily. But sometimes with these prosthetics, the battery can be difficult to get to because it requires you to either like remove the prosthetic entirely or have a specific adapter for it, which is not always available. The other thing was like with the weight, it's something that depending on the prosthetic type, you can have different ways to distribute it. Some, like the majority of robotic prosthetics that you see more in mainstream usage are sort of just attached to like a stump that is left over from where the amputation occurred and are directly attached to there. There are others, however, that are actually done to the body where they're attached by a full body harness and can actually redistribute the weight a little bit more balanced across the body and make a heavier prosthetic a little bit more wieldy than, or a little less wieldy than a simple regular prosthetic that's just on the stump.
So I kind of want to just go over a couple of like these new and upcoming use cases or like designs that I think are really interesting. So a couple of years ago, I found an article dated from almost exactly 2 years ago, February of 2016. So we talked about like myoelectric prosthesis, which have, you know, they have sensors that are on your body and can kind of detect electrical signals that are being sent through your skin or something like that. But they actually have a more advanced prototype or more advanced functionality that they can control a robotic hand just via like interfacing with the brain and not just electrical signals that are sent through the body. And they can control individual fingers via thought with greater than 75% accuracy. And they actually got that up to what they said is 88% accuracy by grouping the ring finger and pinky together, which is actually something that is what the brain normally does. Like, you don't necessarily move your pinky and ring finger separately. And so it's much more natural for a person who's operating this to operate it like they're like natural limbs.
That actually makes a lot of sense. I've always wondered with like building prosthetics and stuff like that, if it's something that we could do as just like modeling it directly off of the natural form of the arm, like including like the tendons and any sort of like kind of shortcuts that the brain has already done, much like with what you just brought up with moving the pinky and the ring finger together. Like, I'm sitting here trying to do that right now and I'm having trouble moving one individually. So I wonder if there's any other shortcuts that we could probably eventually find as we develop the technology more.
So I'm super curious, knowing that neither, at least as far as I know, neither of the two of you have a prosthetic limb or part of any kind. What kind of drew you guys towards this topic? And like, why do you guys find it so interesting? And B, what do you think is like what do you guys think is the coolest thing that they are looking at using a prosthesis for? Like modern, like looking into kind of thing.
I am like very interested in kind of this intersection. One, I just really like engineering and I really like robotics. Carter and I had like some really fun doing robotics in college. And it's also like a fun, maybe not fun topic to think about, but it's the kind of the gut feeling that everybody has that man is mortal, and having ways that we can like skirt by that mortalness, whether it's like ways that we can like fix ourselves after we've been damaged or, you know, prolong our lives is, I think, at least subconsciously in everybody's interest. And yeah, Ian, do you have anything to add to that?
Oh yeah, no, I was just gonna say, like, for me, it was always something that, you know, I grew up with a military family, so like the fact of people getting injured and either having different prosthetics was something that I've always sort of had an awareness of, that thankfully nobody in my direct family has had to have that, and neither have I. But just the thought of building something to assist another person who has lost that sort of functionality has just been a really interesting thing to me, at least.
Yeah, and like, maybe not, it may not be what we're covering today, but like I'm also just like very interested in like how technology can help people who are, you know, like how technology can help people in like very interesting ways. So my mom actually was an occupational therapist who worked with disabled kids who wouldn't need like prosthetics, but they do need like basically very specialized technology depending on what disabilities they have. And, you know, I, my day-to-day job, I'm not necessarily using my engineering knowledge to help people, or at least not directly help people who could benefit from it, but it's at least fun to think about.
Yeah, I just think, like, you know, the way that Scott's coming from it is really interesting just with the looking at it from the engineering side of it, where for me it's interesting building into it from the psych side of it, of how to actually build something that isn't a normal part of the human body, building an artificial limb that will directly interface with the human brain or nervous system. Just the thought of doing that is just something that I find really impressive and just super interesting to see that sort of connection between the two.
Yeah, and as an example of something that's super cool and super nice to know that like it may exist in the future as a real usable thing for people who need it, I found this article that I and some research I did that DARPA is basically making a Luke Skywalker arm.
What?
It's a robotic prosthetic arm that has like basically individual control of the major muscle groups, so you can like move around, you can move the fingers. But it also gives feedback in the other direction. It doesn't just take input. It gives output to the brain to the point where, like, they put a patient with it through a test, and he could tell people what fingers were being touched, and to the point when somebody touched two fingers at the same time, he asked who was playing a trick on him. In the same vein, there's, like, a video of somebody rock climbing wearing this. It's not a... maybe not the most graceful demonstration if you've seen, like, pro rock climbers, like some of my friends, but, like, he's succeeding at climbing up a rock wall, which is something that, if you've never rock climbed before, it takes both like dexterity and a lot of feedback from your hands, so you know when you're going to fall.
Yeah, that was one of the articles that I saw. Like the fact that they actually were able to give that sort of detailed tactile response to the person was nothing short of amazing. The project that they had that DARPA was working on was revolutionizing prosthetics. And the fact that it was released, I believe, was it last year or 2015 was whenever they had the conference that came out with it, where they're like, this is what we worked on and this is as far as we've gotten. They haven't released anything else out. So like, I really just want to see what the development that they've made since that point is. But like that relates directly into the area of like neuroprosthetics, which is like one of my huge parts that I could probably go on for hours about. But these are things that are built directly off of the interface between a human brain and nervous system and a prosthetic device, directly relating to each other. Whereas like a lot of common prosthetics are ones that are done either by like direct movement of muscles or by sensors that are attached to the skin, which can be done in two different ways. But like the neuroprosthetics are directly connecting into the person's nervous system. And those are things such as like the cochlear implants for like auditory prosthetics, or you can have visual ones such as like, you know, the standard bionic eye that everybody kind of thinks of.
You
with
can
that
have
term.
Bionic eyes? They make prosthetic eyes? Are you kidding me?
No, there's actually work that they've done where they've like created prosthetic retinas that
so cool.
are able to shape the like light coming in a lot easier for somebody who's blind. They're not as well done or well developed as the cochlear implants are, but the work is getting there as they continue improving. They also have work that stimulates like the visual cortex directly if the issue is there, but there's all a bunch of other different areas involving vision that they do work with. They also have things such as like pain relief prosthetics, which is something like a spinal cord stimulator. Which is essentially like a smaller pack that's inserted right around the person's spinal column and can actually give it shocks of electricity that will help either numb or relieve pain in that area if that's a thing that a person like has to deal with. And just the fact that like this is technology that we have, like the earliest prosthetics were just pieces of wood that people would use as like a foot or a hand. The medieval era, they used to have like solid metal arms or hands that knights could use for things such as like holding a shield or a lance or holding on to reins on a horse, but there was like no mechanical movement. And we've gotten to the point now where we're literally working on how to control mechanical artificial limbs with just brain signals. Like, the fact that this is where we've gotten to with it is just amazing to me. The fact that you have this sort of development.
So I know you mentioned like a lot of the neuro parts and you can kind of control it with your mind. On a very basic level, how exactly does that work?
So with like the way that it connects to the device in the person's like brain?
Yeah, like how can they, I guess I don't understand the connection between hooking on this prosthetic, like hand, and somebody being able to like think, ah, yes, now I can move the wrist left or right. I guess I don't understand that connection.
Okay, so like what Scott said earlier when he was going over like the history of robotic prosthetics is that, you know, there's sensors that are used to pick up information. They relay that to the controller in the device, and then that controller sends the information from the sensors into the actuators. Actuators provide feedback, send it back into the controller. Controller sends that back to the sensors and the user. The sensors are really kind of an interesting part because there's kind of three different ways in robotic prosthetics that sensors are done. They're done as either biosensors on top of the skin that read the electrical current and like signal input from nerve endings right below the skin. There are other ones that are needle electrodes that are like directly implanted into a muscle group that relay like contractions into those muscles or from those muscles. And then there's also a type of solid state electrode array that actually has nerve fibers from the person grown through them to relay direct information from the electricity running through the nerves.
Yeah. And so a large part of like the more advanced like robotic prosthetics is you have all these sensors and you can get a bunch of inputs, and there's like very sophisticated computer software basically that is basically turning the signals that you get as input from the person and turning it into like useful information for the controller. So there's like, I don't want to describe it as like a magic black box, but it's basically sophisticated algorithms, and there's a training step that has to go through for every person. They can basically have this software recognize patterns and translate those patterns into like commands for the like the low level motors and stuff to do. And so that's one of the like the areas that can grow very rapidly, but is also very hard to kind of grow, as you need very sophisticated algorithms, like basically artificial intelligence or machine learning, to get these things perfectly accurate. And it's something that will take a lot of time and will still require training per person.
Yeah, which, like, the training for, per person, I think, is, like, the really big part of it. Because essentially what you're doing is, depending on whether you do a type of, like, nerve or a type of surgery called, you know, targeted muscle reinnervation or targeted sensory reinnervation, it determines, like, how quickly you could potentially be able to learn this new movement. With the muscle reinnervation, it's where the electrodes are put to read off of the motor nerves from the muscles that contain, like, that move the amputated limb. Or the targeted sensory reinnervation is whenever the sensory nerves are sent to places right underneath the skin, and that's where it reads off of. The targeted sensory goes directly off of the nervous system. But, like, there was an individual who was part of the Hopkins University Applied Physics Laboratory, and they were part of the modular prosthetic limbs development. And it took them 10 days of training before they were able to use, like, the limbs to pick up objects and move them. They could also independently move both the arms at the same time, which was actually the first recorded time that that has ever happened. And that was for a participant in the study who was a double arm prosthetic and had both of his arms amputated at his shoulders.
So I just wanted to wrap up that, like, we've talked about really, really cool stuff today. And it makes me really hopeful for the people that actually need this stuff. Like, the engineering stuff is really great, but it's also like the people aspect is also like kind of very heartwarming. But despite all like the cool advances, like, even most of the articles I read, like, they have great prototypes and they're constantly progressing, but like commercial and like production use is still like coming, and like the improvements that you see today will like take a while to productionize, and even then will be really expensive. So it's something that like still needs a lot of work, research, and probably funding.
Okay, that's going to wrap us up, I think, for this topic. I think that was awesome. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. That's
I learned so much.
Yeah, same for me. I know literally nothing about this topic. I mean, like, I know a little bit about robotics engineering, but human interfaces, I know nothing about. So that was really cool to learn about. We're going to roll into a quick break here just so that we can regroup a little bit. Before we do that, I would ask that everybody please give a thought to rating us on iTunes and leaving us a review, and also subscribing on iTunes so that you don't miss an episode. Everything that you do in that regard really helps us get more listeners, and we really appreciate it. So we'll be right back. Bye. We are back from the break. Thank you for sticking around through the 30-second music interlude that we have there. Thank you, Scott, for writing that, by the way. I really enjoy it.
Scott, it is really cool that you just casually were like, hey, I'll write us some music, guys, and just I'm just bewilderedly impressed by that.
I'm glad you think that's what happened.
Well, I mean, it took you like 2 hours, so, you know, it pretty solid turnaround time. Anyways, so Diana and I are going to be talking about the video game Overwatch today, the game which is out for PC, PlayStation 4, and Xbox One. Yeah, those are the only three consoles. Not out for Switch yet. I can dream, though. So Overwatch, for those of you who don't know, is a class-based or class-oriented first-person shooter game. And it's a game that has, when I say class-based, I really mean character-based. There are 27 individual characters that you can play in the game. It is a competitive game, meaning that there's no story mode, per se. There's no narrative inside the game for you to play through, at least not normally. Instead, it is a 6v6 style objective-based game, so capture a control point and do a King of the Hill style thing, or push a cart through a town and get it to the end of the map while another team tries to defend against you. So that's sort of the basis of the game. Again, it is a very just competitive game. It draws a lot from MOBAs, which are massive online battle arenas, either that or multiplayer online battle arenas. I can't remember which one it is, if you're at all familiar with that. There are games that each character or each hero, as they're referred to in Overwatch, has a very unique set of abilities that allows them to play very well against some characters or contribute to their team in some unique way, while being shut down by characters on the other team who may be specifically picked to shut down your character. So all modes in Overwatch are objective-based. You are standing around a point trying to defend it or attack it, not let the other team complete their objective on that point. The way that you do actually get that done is to shoot the other team and kill their characters. Just a quick history of the game. It was released in 2016, actually May 24th, 2016, so we're coming up on the two-year mark right now. It's created by Blizzard Studios. Yeah, right? It feels like so recently that we started playing it. So it was created by Blizzard Studios, which you might also know from World of Warcraft, StarCraft. What am I missing, guys? Hearthstone. Yep. What else?
Diablo.
Heroes of the Storm.
Heroes of the Storm, yes. And actually, Overwatch, some people don't know this, was built on the bones of a canceled Blizzard game, a canceled MMO called Titan, which was canceled in 2014. So that's just a little fun fact there about Overwatch.
So one of the most wonderful things about Overwatch is, like Carter said, there is no story mode in the game. It is all matches and competitions and whatnot. However, there is actually a lot of rich lore and backstory that goes with each and every one of the heroes, each and every one of the places where you actually play the game, each map that you have objectives on. There is, the Blizzard team itself has written a solid backstory and lore for each hero in their motivations and who they're fighting for. Overwatch, which is the name of the game, used to be a organization that was kind of like a more aggressive UN, in that there were special heroes who had abilities, and they essentially went about the world working with the UN as a way of solving problems and robot uprisings and all sorts of things. And then at some point there was a bunch of incidents happened and they lost a lot of popularity, and a massive base was blown up and they ended up being disbanded. And the long story short is that a lot of the old members have started to try and get back Overwatch together. So you, as the audience, are slowly piecing together and finding out along the way what happened to Overwatch. Who were the original members of Overwatch? Who were the new heroes in the world since Overwatch? And they are constantly turning out lore, so between heroes and games, you are constantly getting small tidbits, notes, and letters as time goes on that give you more and more pieces to the relationship between some heroes and why they're doing this, or why are they with this group versus that group, or why does it seem like they're doing bad things? And so they have a lot of comics out. They've actually just released an anthology of a lot of the early comics that's available on Amazon. You can buy it physically. All the comics are free online, also on the Blizzard website. But in addition to that, because Blizzard makes a lot of money, they have the ability to put out these really amazing looking cinematics. So a lot of heroes have their own personal cinematic, and it is just kind of a short video of really quality looking graphics that give you a great glimpse into the world. And so, like Carter said, this can be a very competitive game, but what really sets Overwatch apart, it is that it is also very enjoyable, and it is very easy on a lot of different levels. The art style in particular, like I was mentioning with the cinematics, that the cinematics are really quality animation, just top notch. And the actual in-game art is also really good. You have it, it's more in kind of an animated style, but you also don't cross that uncanny valley. You don't get the kind of creepy looking faces. The art style is well put together enough that they look like realistic people without looking too cartoonish. So you get some kind of seriousness into it. There's a lot of discourse in that Overwatch is progressive in the sense that it does not have a lot of the same sexualization initially of some characters that games like World of Warcraft or StarCraft does, which Blizzard also produced. It's actually considered really good on that level compared to a lot of games, but it's still not up to a really solid standard. There are a lot of characters who you kind of look at not only just their standard like outfit that is that just comes with the character, and you wonder, why aren't they wearing pants? Give this woman pants. She's fighting battles, just give her some pants. And then you have snipers who have elaborate tight-fitting dresses and high heels, and yeah, Overwatch has done a really wonderful job improving their sexualization and their treatment of female characters, but at the same time there is some discourse about this game about why are you fighting in high heels that don't look comfortable? Breastplates for armor are impractical and should never be worn. They could actually trap a blade in. Don't, if you're sword fighting, ladies, don't use a breastplate. You could kill yourself. And give Symmetra pants, who's one of my favorite heroes. Give Symmetra pants, 2K18. Why is she not wearing pants?
Just go with Vishkar skin. That's where it's at.
Yeah, that's the nice part, is that there are different skins in the game that you can unlock through levels or that you can buy in loot boxes. And some of them are actually a lot of some of them are actually some really big improvements on some of the standard skins.
Yeah, so with the variety of characters, like Diana was saying, there's a lot of characters in the game. There's actually 27 at the moment characters to choose from, which have a very wide range of abilities. And each of those have their own cosmetics within them. So 27 heroes, roughly 15 character skins each. I'm not doing that math. That's too hard. A lot of skins, so you have a lot of visual variety there, and that's discounting even all of the cosmetics, all of the cosmetics that aren't skins. So you know, there's things like character emotes where you can dance on the point, or there's sprays that you can leave all around. Yeah, or you can just take a nap. There's a hero that does that as her ability. Because there's such a wide variety of heroes, you know, moving away from the cosmetics, there's so much variety to how the game is played. There are different roles within the game. So the three roles are generally considered to be healer, which heals your team as they play. There's the tank role, which provides essentially a damage sponge. So you take damage when the rest of your team can't. So you have a very large health pool. And then there's DPS, which stands for damage per second. And that's just a role that's built to get the job done. You know, the glass cannon of your team. And even within those three very broad categories, there's a lot that you can find within that that can suit your own particular play style. I know I hadn't, before I started playing this game, played any first-person shooters. And so I was really bad at aiming when I first started. I've since gotten a lot better. I felt that coming. And so, you know, earlier when I started playing, I would play characters like Torbjorn, who builds auto aiming turrets, or Lucio, who is a healer who does area of effect healing, so you just have to stand near him for him to get the job done. But now that I've sort of increased my skill level a little bit, I've transferred over to characters like Zenyatta, who is a healer who also does a lot of damage with some precision placed shots. And so as you play through the game, you know, I at least, I don't know about you guys, I find myself shifting from hero to hero, character to character, sort of throughout my career. I think right now I've got about 800 hours into Overwatch, which is a scary thought to think. That's too many days. But in that
all
career,
in a row.
Yeah, all in a row. I've actually only owned Overwatch for, I'm not doing that math either. I keep backing myself into this doing math corner and like, what's...
I mean, you're a physics major. You're supposed to be good at math.
That's wrong. Don't
physics
put me
is
in that
math,
box.
Right?
But anyways, like, I can think off the top of my head, I started as a Lucio player, and then I transitioned into playing Mercy, and then after that I went to Roadhog, and then after that I went to Reinhardt, and then I went back to Roadhog, and then I went to Zarya. And so, like, I've just sort of transitioned through all of these characters over time, and it's been just, you know, every time I do this sort of transition, it makes just a vast difference in how I experience the game, because it refreshes the game for me.
And that's one of the other really wonderful things about Overwatch is Carter's right. Each person kind of has their own experience in how they start and where they start and where they end up now. And so I started playing Lucio and Junkrat. And with Junkrat, you launch a ton of grenades that do a lot of damage, but you don't really aim a lot. So I never had to worry about aiming. And then you transition through different heroes, and that's what really makes Overwatch fun, is that you can decide one day, hey, I'm going to go and get good at this. One day I decided, hey, I am going to go and get good at Mercy, like be really good at Mercy. I know that I have personally enjoyed watching Ian be like, hey, I'm going to get really good at Sombra. Ready to watch me play Sombra? And it's just really
still not good at Sombra.
I can attest to that.
I think you're doing much better. But it's really wonderful, not only for you, but your friends to kind of cross that, because you also end up being like, hey, you were Carter. You started playing Lucio. I'm playing Lucio now. Carter sends me a 200-page book on how to get good at Lucio.
Oh, I did do that. That's right. I forgot about that. I didn't write it. I didn't just sit down and write you a 200-page notebook on how to be a Lucio player. But yeah, it's a game that is available on all skill levels. It is a game that keeps coming back for me because it keeps refreshing itself with new heroes and new maps that you can play on. All of this, you know, gameplay content comes out free. You know, the Blizzard, you know, after your initial, I think, $40 purchase for the base game, if it's not on sale, you get all of the gameplay content for free. And the only thing that you are even able to pay for is cosmetics, which come in loot boxes, which I know have experienced a lot of controversy recently for how loot boxes affect games, but we're not going to dive into that because we don't have the time.
Carter and I play the game kind of differently, and that's one of the nice things is that Overwatch is split up into two main modes. Is people like me and Ian who play a lot more casually, and Carter and Scott who play a lot more competitively.
Yes. So I don't want that to sound like I'm pretentious or anything. Scott and I still do play a lot of the casual mode. But Diana makes a good point. It's a very
hard divide. You
filthy
casuals.
I will fight you.
I'll win.
Oh yeah. But anyways, there's a very hard divide on when you're, you know, in like a more competitive atmosphere and when you're not. And there's actually even like a more just having fun version called the arcade, where you can play really goofy modes where characters have 200% health and they and their abilities are on, you know, they come off cooldown like instantly. And
so you can make your own game modes too. There's a custom game mode where people have actually made really insane versions of games. I've watched Ian play a version that was based on Attack on Titan. It was so cool.
That was so terrifying. You play as one character named Genji, and you're trying to kill Reinhardt, which is a tank, and it's terrifying.
Yeah, there's a lot of different ways to play the game. Diana, I want to give you an opportunity to sort of go into why playing casually is a rewarding experience for you. Not that it's not for me, it's just, you know, I feel like I'll have a little more to say on the competitive topic.
So that's not, I normally play casual mode. I have played almost every competitive season a minimum of 10 games, and all that gets me is a ranking, and it's normally pretty low. I majority only play casually. I enjoy casual mode because it is just a really wonderful view of the real love that came out of the Overwatch game. It is a good time where you can mess around. You can pick a sniper when you have terrible aim. Looking at you, Scott.
Ow.
You can decide that you want to play a character that you've never played before and you just want to go for it. You can decide that you want to play a character that you only play and you can just go for it. You don't have to worry about making sure that you have, oh man, okay, we need two tanks, two healers, we need enough DPS, we need these specific DPS damage per second players. You don't have to kind of worry about that. You don't have to worry about getting out of imaginary position where you could get picked off. If you lose a game, you lose a game. Like, it sucks, but you're over it in 2 seconds because you're being put into another one. I have met some really cool people just playing casual Overwatch who are like, guys, watch this. And you just find people doing the goofiest and crazy things. There's so many different modes. Different arcade modes. They switch out every week or so. Sometimes it's a 1v1 mode. Sometimes it is a unlimited heroes kind of mode where you can be 6 of the same hero, which you can't do normally. It's just a really good time to have fun, but also still play the game.
Yeah, for the unlimited heroes mode where you're not restricted to picking only one of each hero on your team, I'm a huge fan of the Torbjorn power play.
Team Turret.
Team Turret, that's right.
Six Mays, though.
Six Winstons is obviously the only viable strategy.
That's true. Six Winstons is very powerful. If you've never played Overwatch, none of these words mean anything.
But you should try them.
You should try
The last one would just be Donkey Kong all over
Donkey
again.
Donkey Kong.
But that's the wonderful thing about Overwatch is if you have no idea what you're talking about, go play the demo, man. Just go try it. You could be terrible at a lot of the characters have guns. One has a sword. One has a hammer. You don't have to be like, oh man, guys, I can't aim. I've never been good at these games. I have a friend who's starting to play Overwatch recently, and she's super nervous about playing with us who, by the way, I think I've put around 500 hours on this game. She's super worried about playing with us who's played a lot of it, and you don't have to. Not in casual mode, man. In casual mode, you could be level 8 million or you could be level 3. You're still having a good time.
Moving out of the quick play or the casual mode and into the competitive mode, which I would say Scott and I have the most, well, actually, I know this. Scott and I, out of the four of us in this chat, have the most experience in the group in competitive. We generally play competitive together, and so we're generally placed around the same tier. But what I really like about competitive mode, it's competitive. When I was in high school, I played a lot of volleyball, and I got really competitive in it. I wasn't necessarily good, but I really enjoyed the competitive atmosphere. When I got out of that, I went into college and started playing Quidditch, and I got competitive in that. I ended up being vice president of the team for a semester and captain of the team for a semester, and I think we did pretty well there, and I really enjoyed being a part of that competitive atmosphere. After I left the Quidditch team, I started playing Rocket League a lot, which provided that for me. And eventually I got tired of that, and Diana introduced all of us into Overwatch. And it took me a little bit, but I was missing the competitive atmosphere. And then once I got into Overwatch, I was able to start doing things like, you know, thinking about game theory again and how to apply strategy to what I was doing and learning about my failings and analyzing them and really strategizing in this game and using that sort of mindset that I had been missing.
Yeah, the one thing I enjoy, like, I really enjoy playing quick play or the casual mode, because like you can do whatever you want, nobody really cares too much, nobody's gonna yell at you. But also, like, even like ignoring the like I want to win aspect, it's really nice to have a game where everybody on your team is trying as hard as you are. Like, when you get into a competitive mode, there's kind of like this inherent everybody at least wants to try to win, which you don't necessarily have in quick play because of the reasons that we've said earlier. And so it's more of a, like, everybody's on, like, a fair playing field, and you don't have to worry that somebody in your team is just, like, kind of screwing around.
Yeah, so beyond just the atmosphere, which I love, I love the concept behind it. A lot of times this competitive atmosphere and the layer of anonymity that online games give people sort of give people the confidence to get angrier and be meaner than they should. So that's a negative aspect to competitive, but Scott's right. Just the feeling of being able to try as hard as you can and know that the team that's surrounding you is probably also trying as hard as they can to win this game. But aside from that, I really like Overwatch because as they're always adding in new heroes and changing maps, adding maps, they don't change maps very much, but adding new maps, that means that the styles in which the sort of community has agreed upon as being the best way to play, that's shifting. And so I was talking earlier about how my playstyle has shifted from character to character. That's at least in part driven by this shifting hero balance. And so if one hero becomes less powerful, I might consider swapping off of them because it may not be the most effective choice for the team. And so that keeps this competitive mode fresh even after, I don't know, I'd probably think that we have 400 plus hours in competitive, Scott. That seems...
It's several hundred. Yeah. Past that, you know we have no life.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Trust me. This is not looking good for any of us in this chat. Well, Ian's fine.
Was that even a question of if any of us have a life?
Yeah. Okay. So just wrapping up Overwatch. Overwatch is a really wonderful game, and I would honestly encourage anybody just to try the demo. I'd never played a first-person shooter before this. Carter never really played a lot of MOBA before this. This wasn't everybody's wheelhouse, and we all found something we really enjoyed about it, and we all found it in different ways. Don't worry if you're level one and you're brand new. And, like, you'll just get there. You'll find your niche. I would encourage everyone to play this game because there's so much to find out of it. Do y'all have any other closing comments about the game?
I have a closing comment that I played Dota, I played Heroes of New Earth, and I played a lot of shooting games, and I'm still awful at Overwatch, so even if you're good at those, you'll probably be bad and on the same playing field.
Same. I played a lot of console, though, before I got into, like, playing on PC, so even then, I'm still not good at it. Still fun, though.
Still fun.
Still fun.
Yeah, it's still fun. All right, well, that's been the Brought to the Table podcast, guys. Thank you for listening. Please, if you have any comments about robotic prosthesis or Overwatch, we would love to hear them. Questions, comments, love, beauty, madness, any of those, we'll take it. You can find...
No firstborns.
Secondborns only. We'll take the spare. You can find us on Facebook, Tumblr, Twitter. We're pretty much Brought to the Table on all of those, except for Twitter. We're at To the Table Podcast. Please feel free to comment at us. And we also love it when you email us at broughttothetable@gmail.com. Please leave a review on iTunes. We love hearing what you guys think, and we really would love it if you guys have any suggestions for what you want us to talk about. We always love it when somebody else is like, guess what I brought to the table? Thanks for coming to our table today. Bye.
Bye.
Later.